The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here at the Free Library, and I'm very pleased to welcome our guests. If you've been reading any of the major newspapers lately, either national or international, you can't help but to have seen the avalanche of accolades proffered in the wake of Helen Oyeyemi's and Oke Ndebe's new novels. Miss Oyeyemi last joined us 7 years ago for her second novel, The Opposite House. Her other books include What Is For Witching, winner of the 2010 Somerset Maugham Award, and Mr. Fox, which won a 2012 Hurston Wright Legacy Award. Last year, she was named one of Granta's best young British novelists. Of her new book, Boy Snow Bird, Ron Charles of the Washington Post writes, "The outline of Oyeyemi's remarkable career glimmers with pixie dust. Her latest novel continues on this bewitching path. Under her spell, the fairy tale conceit makes a brilliant setting in which to explore the alchemy of racism and the weird ways in which identity can be transmuted in an instant, from beauty to beast, or vice versa." Miss Oyeyemi will share the stage tonight with fellow writer Oke Ndebe. Mr. Ndebe teaches African and African diaspora literatures at Brown University. He earned his MFA and PhD degrees from the University of Massachusetts and has taught at Trinity College, Bard College, and the University of Lagos as a Fulbright Scholar. His previous books include the novel Arrows of Pain, as well as a co-edited essay collection entitled Writers, Writing on Conflicts and Wars in Africa. The Los Angeles Times calls Mr. Ndebe's new novel, Foreign Gods, Inc., unforgettable, a page-turning allegory about the globalized world. Please welcome our first presenter, Helen Oyeyemi.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming out on this chilly night. I'm really happy to be back here. A little bit jet-lagged. I came in from Prague 2 days ago, and I'm amazed to say that the weather in Prague is actually better than it is here, like the first time since ever. So I'm here to talk to you about my book, Boy Snow Bird, which is my retelling of the Snow White fairy tale set in 1950s and 1960s Massachusetts. And one of my main characters is a young woman who finds herself accidentally becoming a wicked stepmother. So I'm just going to read you the beginning of her story. Her name is Boy. Okay. Nobody ever warned me about mirrors, so for many years I was fond of them and believed them to be trustworthy. I'd hide myself away inside them, setting two mirrors up to face each other so that when I stood between them, I was infinitely reflected in either direction. Many, many me's. When I stood on tiptoe, we all stood on tiptoe, trying to see the first of us and the last. The effect was dizzying, a vast pulse, not quite alive, more like the working of an automaton. I felt the reflection at my shoulder like a touch. I was on the most familiar terms with her, same as any other junior dope too lonely to be selective about the company she keeps. Mirrors showed me that I was a girl with a white blonde pigtail hanging down over one shoulder, eyebrows and lashes the same color, still near black eyes, and one of those faces some people call harsh and others call fine-boned. It was not unusual for me to fix a scarf around my head and spend an afternoon pretending that I was a nun from another century. My forehead was high enough. And my complexion is unpredictable, goes from near bloodless to scalded and back again, all without my permission. There are still days when I can only work out whether or not I'm upset by looking at my face. I did fine at school. I'm talking about the way boys reacted to me, actually, since some form of perversity caused me to spend most lessons pretending to absorb much less information than I actually did. Every now and then, a teacher got suspicious about a paper I'd turned in and would keep me after school for questioning. "Has someone been helping you?" I just shook my head and shuffled my chair sideways, avoiding the glare of the desk lamp the teacher invariably tried to shine into my eyes. Something about a girl like me writing an A-grade paper turns teachers into cops. I'll take the appraisal of my male peers over that any day. 4 out of 5 of them either ignored me or were disgustingly kind, the way nice boys are to the plainest Jane they know. But that was only 4 out of 5. Number 5 tended to lose his balance for some reason and follow me around making the most extraordinary pleas and offers, as if some kind of bug had gotten into him. Female classmates got anonymous notes that said things like, "So, I fall for you, probably because I can see and hear. I see you, those eyes, that smile, and when you laugh, yeah, I fall. I'm not normally this sincere, so you might not be able to guess who I am, but here's a clue, I'm on the football team. If you feel like taking a chance, wear a blue ribbon in your hair, and I'll walk you home." The notes I received were more tormented, more of the "you've got me going out of my mind" variety. Not that I lost any sleep over that stuff. How could I when I had a little business going on the side? Boys paid me to write notes to other girls on their behalf. They trusted me. They had this notion that I knew what to say. I just wrote whatever I thought that particular girl wanted to hear and collected dollar bills on delivery. The notes my friends showed me were no work of mine, but I kept my business quiet, so it stands to reason that if anyone else had a similar business, they'd have been discreet about it too. When my hair started to darken, I combed peroxide through it. As for character, mine developed without haste or fuss. I didn't interfere, it was all there in the mirrors. Suppose you're born on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the year 1930-something. Suppose your father's a rat catcher. Your absent mother is never discussed, to the extent that you nurse a theory that you're a case of spontaneous generation. The interior of the house you grow up in is pale orange and rust brown. At dawn and sunset, shadows move like hands behind the curtains. Silhouettes of men with brill-creamed waves in their hair gathered on the street corner to sing about their sweethearts in 7-part harmony. The streetcar whispering along its track. Mrs. Phillips next door beating blankets. Your father is an old-fashioned man. He kills rats the way his grandfather taught him. This means that there are little cages in the basement, usually a minimum of 7 at any given time. Each cage contains a rat, lying down and making a sound somewhere between twittering and chattering. The basement smells of sweat. The rats are panicking, starving. They make these sounds, and then you see holes in their paws and in their sides. There's nothing else in that cage with them, and all your father does to them at first is give them water, so it stands to reason that it's the rats making the holes, eating themselves. When your father's about to go out on a job, he goes to the basement, selects a cage, and pulls its inhabitants' eyes out. The rats that are blind and starving are the best at bringing death to all the other rats. That's your father's claim. Your father puts 3 or 4 cages in the trunk of his car and drives away. He comes back late in the evening when the job's done. I guess he makes a lot of money. He does business with factories and warehouses. They like him because he's very conscientious about the cleanup afterward. So that's Papa. Cleanest hands you'll ever see in your life. He'll punch you in the kidneys from behind, or he'll thump the back of your head and walk away sniggering while you crawl around on the floor, stunned. He does the same to his lady friend who lives with you, until he starts going for her face. She'll put up with a lot, but not that. One day she leaves a note under your pillow. It says, "Look, I'm sorry. For what it's worth, I'd say you deserve better. Take care of yourself." You don't get too upset about her departure, but you do wonder who's going to let you bum lucky strikes now. You're all of 15 and you're a jumpy kid. You don't return people's smiles. It's perfectly clear to you that people can smile and smile and still be villains. One of the first things you remember is resting your head against the sink. You were just washing your hair in it, and you had to take a break because when your hair's wet, it's so heavy you can't lift your head without your neck wobbling. So you're resting, and that clean hand descends out of nowhere and holds you face down in the water until you faint. You come around lying on the bathroom floor. There's a burning feeling in your lungs that flares up higher the harder you cough, and the rat catcher's long gone. He's at work. Where does character come into it? Just this. I've always been pretty sure I could kill someone if I had to. Myself or my father, whichever option proved most practical. I wouldn't kill for hatred's sake. I'd only do it to solve a problem. And only after other solutions have failed. That kind of bottom line is either in your character or it isn't, and like I said, it develops early. My reflection would give me a slow nod from time to time, but would never say what she was thinking. There was no need. A couple of teachers asked me if I was applying to college, but I said, can't afford it. Actually, I was pretty sure that the rat catcher could, but I didn't want to have that or any conversation with him. He hit me when one of his caged rats bit him. He hit me when I pronounced a word in a certain way that made him think I was acting stuck up. He told me that the difference between him and other people was that other people would only think about kicking me in the shins whenever I used a long word, but he went ahead and took action. He'd hit me when I didn't flinch at the raising of his arm, and he'd hit me when I cowered. He hit me when Charlie Vaychik came over to respectfully ask if he could take me to prom. I seem to recall he began that particular beating in a roundabout way by walking up to me with a casserole dish and dropping it on my foot. There was almost a slapstick element to it all. I got a sudden notion that if I laughed or asked, "Are you through?" he'd back off. But I didn't try to laugh for fear of coming in too early or too late. There were times I thought the rat catcher was going to knock me out for sure. For instance, the morning he told me to run downstairs and blind a couple of rats real quick for him before I went to school. I said, "No way," and made inner preparations for stargazing. But he didn't really do anything, just pointed at my clothes and said, "Rats paid for those." Then pointed at my shoes and said, "Rats paid for those." And pointed at the food on the table and said, "Rats." He imitated them, and he laughed. The unpredictability of his fist didn't mean he was crazy. Far from it. Sometimes he got awfully drunk, but never to a point where he didn't seem to know what he was doing. He was trying to train me. To do what? I don't know. I never found out because I ran away almost as soon as I turned 20. I wish I knew what took me so long. He didn't even hit me that night. He just sat in his easy chair snoozing after dinner like always. I watched him and I woke up. I kind of just woke up. He was sleeping so peacefully with a half smile on his face. He didn't know how rotten he was. He'll never know, probably never even suspect it. My feet walked me into my bedroom while I thought it over. Then I gave my mattress a goodbye kick. I didn't pack much because I didn't have much. There was only one really important thing in my bag, a flag that Charlie Vaychik had wrapped around my shoulders once when we were watching the 4th of July fireworks over at Herald Square. He said it was a loan, but he'd never asked for it back. Ever since he'd started at medical school, people talked about him as if he'd died, but he was the same old Charlie. He wrote to me from upstate, and he mentioned the flag and that night. I'd written back that I was still looking after the flag for him. It took up a bunch of room in my bag, but I couldn't just leave it there with the rat catcher. I did look for the key to the basement, but I couldn't find it. Hard to say how much of a good turn it would have been to set those rats free after standing by while they'd starved anyway. 3 times I opened and closed the front door, testing the depth of the rat catcher's sleep, trying to make the softest click possible. The 3rd time, I heard him shift in the chair and he mumbled something. The 4th time I opened the door, I didn't have the nerve to close it behind me. I just ran. 2 girls playing hopscotch outside 3 Wishes Bakery saw me coming and hopped right out of the way. I ran 6 or 7 blocks, the street one long dancing seam of brick and bicycle bells, hats and stockings, only stopping to turn corners when traffic lights wouldn't let me pass. I ran so fast, I don't know how my pump stayed on. A crosstown bus, then a subway ride to Port Authority. Nervous simply isn't the word. I stayed standing on the bus ride, stuck close to the driver, looking behind us, looking ahead, my heart stirring this way and that like so much hot soup, my hands stuck deep in my pockets so my sleeves couldn't be grabbed. I was ready for the rat catcher to appear. So ready. I knew what I'd do. If he tried to take me by the elbow, if he tried to turn me around, I'd come over all tough guy, slam my skull into his forehead. I stayed ready until I got to Port Authority, when the priority shifted to not getting trampled. I really wasn't expecting that kind of hullabaloo. If there'd been more time, I just have stood stock still with my eyes closed and my hands clapped over my ears, waiting for a chance to take a step toward the ticket counter without being pushed or yelled at. Folks were stampeding the last bus with everything they had. It was as if anyone unlucky enough to still be on the station platform turned into a pumpkin when the clock struck 12. I tumbled into the bus with a particularly forceful gang of seven or so, a family, I think, tumbled off the bus again by way of getting caught up in the folds of some man's greatcoat, and scuttled over to the ticket counter to try to find out just where this last bus was going. I saw the rat catcher in the ticket line, long and tall and adamant, four people away from the front, and I pulled my coat collar over my head. I saw the rat catcher get out of a cab and stride toward me, veins bulging out of his forehead, looking like he meant nothing but business. I whirled around and saw the rat catcher again, pounding on the bus window, trying to find me among the passengers. Okay, so he wasn't really there at all, but that was no reason to relax. It'd be just like him to turn up, really turn up, I mean, a moment or two after my guard came down. I saw him at least 20 times coming at me from all angles before I reached the counter. And when I finally did get there, the guy behind it told me it was closed for the night. When do you open up again? 6 in the morning. But I've got to leave tonight. He was basically a jerk. Jerk isn't a term I make free and easy use of. I don't go around saying he, she, it is a jerk. But this guy was something special. There I was looking right at him through the glass as I wept desperately, and there he was petting his moustache as if it was a small and fractious creature. He sold me a ticket 5 minutes before the bus left, and he only did it because I slipped him an extra $5. I felt a bout of sarcasm coming on when he took the money, but made sure I had the ticket in my hand before I said, "My hero!" I was going to the last stop on account of its being the farthest away. The ticket said the last stop was Flax Hill and I'd never heard of it. "Flax Hill, whereabouts would you say that is?" "New England," my hero said. "You're going to miss that bus." "Where in New England? I mean, what state? Vermont or what?" He studied me with narrowed eyes, selecting a nerve, the fat, juicy nerve of mine he'd most like to get upon. "Or what?" he said. He drew the blinds down over the counter window and I ran. There were only 2 seats left on the bus, one beside an elderly man and one beside a coloured woman who was sleeping with her head laid up against the window. The man smelled somewhat urinaceous, so I sat beside the woman, who opened her eyes, asked me if she should get up, nodded and fell asleep again when I said no. She looked just about worn out. Across the aisle, a baby started screaming, and its mother bounced it up and down on her knees, trying to soothe it into good behaviour. But the shrieking went on and on, primal, almost glad. This protest was righteous. I couldn't make up my mind whether the baby was male or female. The only certainties were near baldness and incandescent rage. The kid didn't like its blanket, or its rattle, or the lap it was sat on, or the world. The time had come to demand quality. This continued until the mother, who had been staring into space, suddenly came to and gave her child a particularly vicious look, along with a piece of information. "I don't have a baby that acts this way." The baby seemed taken aback, hiccuped a few times, and fell silent. I held that talisman ticket of mine smooth between my hands right up until the bus pulled out of the station, even though deep down I knew there was no way the rat catcher could have figured out where I was. It wouldn't have occurred to him that I'd leave the state. Maybe he wouldn't look too hard. Maybe he'd just shrug and think, well, that's cut down the grocery bill. Actually, I knew he would be murderously mad. I could almost hear him bellowing, "I'm a rat catcher! No two-bit wretch runs out on me, even if she is my daughter." Don't think of his face. Flax Hill, Flax Hill. With a name like that, it was probably the countryside I was going to. Moonlight, hay, cows chewing cud and exchanging slow conversational moos. It was a scenario I felt doubtful about, but I was game. I had to be. As pillows go, my bag served pretty well. I listened to the drumming of the bus wheels on the road, made a note that running away from home was as easy as pie once you'd made your mind up to it, and fell asleep with my limbs carefully arranged so as not to touch my neighbours. That's the first chapter. Thank you for listening.
Good evening. All right, I'm going to tell you what's at stake, and then we're going to try again. I come from a culture where before you speak to any gathering, you are expected to offer salutation. And if you didn't get a response, that would be a polite way of saying to you, take a hike. So now you know what's at stake, right? So let me say it again, good evening.
Good evening.
Much better. Lovely. It's a delight, Helen Oyeyemi, to read with you. I have been a great admirer of Helen's work and have been reading this novel, this particular, her latest offering, over the last 2 days, and I've been really spellbound. So it's a particular delight of mine to read with you. Anybody who knows anything about me knows that I'm an anti-reader. What does that mean? I like to tell stories, and then I read like a small snippet, like little taste. So I'm going to offer you a choice, because I also believe in democracy. We could open this fabulous book and read 20 pages from it, or I could tell you some stories first. Stories, right? I knew you were going to make that choice. All right. So the first story that I'd like to tell has to do with my name. My name is Oke, and what kind of name is that? Right? Anybody curious about that? I'd like by saying that it's an Oke name. Right? Wouldn't you say? Now, in Nigeria, and I have a few Nigerians in the audience, Oke is a fairly common name. But then I came to America to find out that Oke was often the subject of great hilarity. And so one day I met a graduate student from Botswana, and I introduced myself. I said, my name is Oke, and this guy started laughing. And for about 10 minutes, he just couldn't gather himself. He just kept laughing and laughing, and I knew that there was some story there, so I waited patiently. When he finished, after he calmed down, he said to me, "You wouldn't believe what happened yesterday." So I said, "I can't wait to hear it." So he told me that he'd been to Stop and Shop in Amherst, Massachusetts, where I lived at the time. It had snowed quite heavily, and he was pushing his cart down an aisle, and in the opposite direction came a woman. As they passed each other, they made eye contact. The woman said to him, "How do you like the snow?" And he said, "I don't like it at all. I like it warm." And the woman said, I detect an accent there. Where are you from?" And she said, "Botswana." And she said, "Is that in Africa?" He said, "Yes." And she said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And the woman then stopped and started talking to him for a while. About 10 minutes into this conversation, the woman said to him, "Wow, I can't believe you are okay." And the guy said, "Is there anything about me that suggests I'm not okay?" And she said, "No, it's just that I've heard so many stories about you." And he said, "You have?" She said, "Yeah." And he said, "Like what?" And she said, "Well, I hear that you are in town in Amherst to set up an international magazine published by the Nigerian great Nigerian author, Chinua Achebe, there are top things fall apart, which was what I came to this country to do. At which point this guy said, it's not true. I'm a graduate student. And the woman said, but you told me you were okay. And the guy said, yes, I'm fine. At which point this woman said, no, there's actually a guy in town whose name is okay, so I thought I was meeting him. And he said he left this encounter feeling very upset, that he thought that what was happening was that the woman wanted to pick him up and that he was willing to be picked up. But at midway through the game, the woman changed her mind and then came up with this very silly story about somebody named OK. So the very next day, he met me. And so that's why when I introduced myself, he couldn't control himself. So this became part of my immigrant story. Everywhere that I've read, I've been asked a question whether this story is autobiographical. And my answer is hell no. I'm not in the business of stealing deities or stealing anything much. Even though 10 days after I came to this country, I was arrested by the police. And a couple of weeks ago, I was in D.C. to give a reading, and I said that I was still expecting my invitation to the White House to have a beer with the police officer who arrested me. You know the Henry Lee Gates story, right? Yeah, I think I'm entitled to one beer from the president. Well, what happened was that before I came to this country, an uncle of mine had said to me, okay, whatever you do when you get to America, do not make eye contact when you talk to Americans. And he said to me, every American carries a gun. And if you look them in the face, they will think you have been provocative and they will shoot you. Well, my uncle had never been to America. So you wonder where he formed this impression. Well, in those days, years ago, from time to time, a movie will be shown out in the open. I mean, those of us who are Africans will remember this. And these were usually Westerns, and they were very old Westerns, grainy affairs, with a discrepancy between a gap between the movement of the lips and the sound of the actors. So nobody quite knew what they were saying. But at some point, usually in a bar, the characters will gather together and say a few words and then stare each other down. That became the precursor to them pulling guns from both sides of the hip and starting to shoot. So my uncle formed this impression that in America, the worst thing you could do to a fellow person is to make eye contact. So he said to me, don't look Americans in the face. So here I was on my 10th day in America. I was at the bus stop waiting to take a bus to University of Massachusetts for a meeting with a Nigerian professor. The police officer was driving past the bus stop, and he and I made eye contact. And I missed a heartbeat. I said, wow, this guy is going to shoot me. So I made a dramatic gesture of looking away as a way of showing contrition, saying to him, I did not intentionally look you in the face. From the corner of my eye, I saw him turn into a side street, and I said, good, I've lost him. Well, about a minute later, I got a tap on my shoulder, and I looked to my right, and here was this tall figure in police uniform. This time, I would not make the mistake of meeting his gaze. So I looked at his chest, and he said to me, sir, do you mind coming to the back of the bus stop? Those of us who are from Nigeria would know that anybody in uniform, much less a police officer, has incredible power in Nigeria. So they will never call you sir, even as a joke, and they will never say, do you mind? What they do is they pull or push you where they want you. So for a minute, there was cultural disorientation. I thought that I had a choice in the matter. That since this man said, sir, that he was being deferential, and so that I could say to him, I mind. I'd much rather see you some other day. But on second thought, I said, he was genial, so let me make his acquaintance immediately. So I said, I didn't mind. So I came to the back of the bus stop, and he folded his hands, and looking down on me now, and of course I was looking at his chest, he said to me, sir, you know what this is about, right? Of course I knew what it was about. I had looked him in the face. But my policy was to deny unto death. Because the moment I said, yes, I looked you in the face, I felt he had the right to shoot. So I said, no, I don't know what it's about. He said, sir, are you sure you don't know what it's about? I said, I don't know. And he said to me, who wants to guess what it was about? Who wants to take a wild guess? Nobody? All right. So the officer said to me, there has been a bank robbery, and you fit the description. At which point I began to stutter. Of course, making sure that I did not compound this rather serious grave situation by making eye contact as I denied being in a bank. And I felt that if I was going to rob a bank in America, I would need far more practice. You see, I would find out where to get a gun, for example. And I've lived in America for 25 years and I haven't quite figured out how to obtain one. Well, at length, the officer said to me, do you have identification on you? I said, no. He said, why not? I said, well, the only form of ID I had on me was my passport. I didn't think it made sense to carry it wherever I went. So he said to me, do you mind if I frisk you? Frisk was not part of my vocabulary at the time. But somehow I knew that whatever frisk meant, I had very little choice. So I said, I don't mind. I could have signed away my life. I said, I don't mind. He asked me to throw my hands up. I did. And he patted me down, convinced that I had no weapons of mass or single destruction. He said to me, do you mind if I take you to your apartment? I'd like to see your passport. Again, I thought that he was going to take me to some isolated place and shoot. But I felt that the best option was to be compliant. So I said, I didn't mind. So he put me in the back of the cruiser, radioed his headquarters and said he'd picked up a suspect who had no identification. Well, Chinua Achebe's two younger children, Chidi and Wando, were spending their Christmas vacation with me. So I walked in and I spoke to them in Igbo. I said, I've been arrested for bank robbery. But I went and got my passport and I showed to the office, and after punching on some little machine, it sufficed to show him that I wasn't the person he was looking for. So he handed me the passport and said, thanks for being a gentleman. As he was about to leave, it occurred to me that in town, there'll be the narrative. People will point to me and say, we don't quite have all the details, but this guy is some kind of criminal. We saw the police pick him up the other day. So I wanted there to be a countervailing narrative where some other people will be saying, we saw the police officer, a police officer drop him at the bus stop. So I said to the officer, borrowing his phrase, do you mind dropping me back at the bus stop? He didn't mind. So he took me to the bus stop, and I arrived at the office of the Nigerian professor, and he wasn't there. So I figured I was late for an appointment. He must be in class. Well, an hour later, he walked into his office rather disheveled and worried. And he saw me and stopped in his tracks. And he said, how did you get here? I said, I've been here for more than an hour. Well, what happened was that he'd stopped at different in Amherst and different surrounding towns, asking if they had somebody called OK in the band. Everywhere he got the answer that they didn't. So finally, he told the Amherst police that he had two witnesses who saw me in a police cruiser and that he was going to go call an attorney. So all of this is sort of grist to my own immigrant experience, and I'm actually writing a series of these essays based on these experiences, and the title is Going Dutch and Other American Misadventures. So you can imagine about the Going Dutch, right? Which happened 4 days after I came here, when I was invited to lunch by an American. And I thought that, as happens in Nigeria, the person who invites you was going to pay. So I went to eat without a dime in my pocket. I got food in my stomach and some cultural lesson called Going Dutch to go with it. So the protagonist of my novel has been to Amherst College, one of the more prestigious liberal arts colleges in this country, and he's got a sound degree in economics. And his expectation is that he's going to get a good corporate job, a job, say, on Wall Street. But then he finds out to get such a job, first he has to navigate something called the green card. And so the process of getting a green card becomes part of the tension in the novel. And once he acquires a green card, he finds that when he applies for a job, sends his resume in, his resume looks excellent on paper. And so he's invited for interviews. But once he arrives and speaks, his accent is so strong that the accent marks him out as foreign. And so it's a series of frustrations that he goes through, not getting any of the jobs that he expects to get. And finally, having driven a cab for years, he reads a story in a magazine called the New York Magazine about a gallery called Foreign Gods Incorporated that buys and sells the statues of deities as well as other sacred objects pushed from different parts of the world. And so he decides to return to his hometown where he steals the statue of what used to be the god of war for his people. And so the novel follows him on this picaresque journey back to his community where he steals a deity. And there's a particularly filial dimension to this drama because the chief priest of the deity is his own uncle. So what I'm going to do is to read two short sections, one earlier in the novel when he attempts to get a green card and is basically taken. And then I'm going to read you an even shorter section toward the end of the novel when he steps into the shrine as his uncle slept in an adjoining room to store away with the deity of Ngene. The god is called Ngene. All right. So thank you for being patient as I did not read. But I'm going to do a tiny little bit of reading, okay? If you don't mind. I mean, if you mind, I'll read a lot. Ike's quest for a green card had begun in 1997, a few months before his graduation. He'd applied for a job at two banks, but when he phoned one bank's human resources department, a female employee called back and left a terse message on his voicemail. "Sir," the woman said, "Bay Bank does not interview aliens unless they produce evidence of authorization to work in America." Later that day, Ike went to visit Harrison Amadu, a Nigerian acquaintance who lived in Springfield, Massachusetts. Harrison was a cab driver, but also knew his way around immigration problems faced by Africans. Through him, Ike contacted a Puerto Rican broker named Ricardo Ortiz, who in turn produced a 22-year-old woman named Jessenia Diaz to be Ike's green card bride. The broker demanded a fee of $5,000 before Jessenia would pose as Ike's wife. With Harrison's help, Ike negotiated the fee down to $3,500, and then he borrowed $1,500 from Harrison to make the down payment. Ike and Jessenia were to meet at the office of the Justice of the Peace to exchange marital vows. They held a rehearsal, Jessenia's face bearing a sneer through it all. Came the appointed date, and Jessenia was nowhere in sight. Ricardo showed up alone with the news that Jessenia's grandmother had taken ill in Puerto Rico and the would-be bride had traveled to be at the matriarch's bedside. "She coming back soon," Ricardo assured, "and then the wedding, it gonna happen." For the next 3 months, there was no Jessenia. Yet, at the end of each month, Ricardo appeared at Ike's door and demanded the due installment of $200. Ike, who combined his studies with a menial job, cleaning several movie theaters, restaurants, and offices at night, chafed at the unfair arrangement. Why did he have to pay to scrape from his meager earnings to make monthly payments for a fugitive bride? His grudge notwithstanding, Ike knew that he had little or no negotiating room. Then came the fourth month when, felled by the flu, he couldn't work for close to 2 weeks. He had no cash to make the installment. He dialed Harrison Amado, hoping again to be bailed out now with a small loan. "You should start driving a cab," Harrison said in a tone drained of all sympathy. "The job brings steady income." The next day, Ike presented himself to Harrison, who introduced him to the office manager of Triple E Taxi Company. With his boosted income, he paid off the bribe-free fee in 3 months. To his dismay, Jessenia remained missing. Even so, Ricardo showed up once or twice each week asking for various sums. "Is a loan," he'll say. "Soon I pay you back." One day, Ike refused any longer to be duped. That night, just past midnight, he was jerked awake by the ring of his phone. He was in the middle of a terrible dream. "My cousin, he say you are playing difficult," said the woman's voice. Confused and agitated, Ike slurred, "You have the wrong number." "Oh yeah," said the female voice in a fighting tone, "you gonna play the wrong number game now?" "Who is this?" Ike asked, sitting up in bed, perplexed. "It's me, Jesse, Ricardo's cousin, Jessenia." Recognition hit, accompanied by a flurry of confused, stuttering statements. "I have been. We need..." "Ricardo said that you..." "I have been looking for you. We need to meet. We have to file a marriage petition." "Oh yeah," said the woman. "I not marrying you. My cousin say you proven difficult." "He kept asking to borrow money and he never paid back," Ike explained. "And he was supposed to bring you." "Bring me? I am bringing unless you pay Ricardo." Ike sulked for several weeks. Then he gathered himself up and relocated to Philadelphia, where he continued to work as a cab driver. From there, he moved to Atlanta and then to Baltimore. Wherever he moved, he brought along that stubborn dream for a green card. The card was the open sesame to a corporate job befitting his education. Often, when he met a woman, he calibrated his interest in her to the likelihood that she would consent to marry him. Until he met Benita, he had had a streak of failures. So that's the quick short section. I have a little more time, right? Yeah, that's the enforcer of time. All right. And usually I'm not used to this sort of the shortness of this kind of 20 minutes, right? I come from a culture where we are constitutionally incapable of brevity. So when I go to conferences and I'm asked to speak for 20 minutes, I spend the time complaining that I don't have enough time. And usually that's not enough time. All right. So this is the moment when Ike sneaks into the shrine of the deity to steal the statue at night. Ike gingerly stepped... Oh, no. I'm reading at the end of it. I should be at the beginning. Ike's hand swept the dark air and it touched the deity's face. His fingers felt something viscous and thick, and he knew it was sacrificial blood. He groped along the statue's wooden outline all the way to his torso. In the dark, his hands could feel the sturdiness of the chiseled wood. The statue rested on a squat base that enabled the deity, in the eye of even casual observers, to exude the air of grandeur appropriate to a god whose department was war. He placed one hand around the statue's neck and the other on his rump and then lifted. Finding it much heavier than he had expected, he put it back down. How could something so spare and lanky prove so dense and earthbound? In the dark, he wondered whether the deity had tensed itself, made his weight leaden, determined to deaden the abductor's will. Ike knew that Ngene was a mobile deity. As a youngster, he had on numerous occasions seen Oswahu, his uncle, hoist it upright on his shoulder and trek to villages far and near, wherever an oath needed to be taken and back. Yet his uncle was not only much older, he was also a man of meager musculature. And years of overwhelming kaikai had made the old man seem frailer than many men his age. Kaikai is locally brewed gin that is like 99% alcohol. So you go figure. If you drink it, it soaks out of your sweat, you know, out of your skin, yeah. Ike flexed, but when he lifted the statue a second time, its weight seemed lighter, mysteriously much lighter. He placed it on his shoulder, the same way he'd seen his uncle carry it, and then turned to leave. He didn't raise his legs high enough. His sneakers scraped against the earthen floor and screeched. His heart jumped. From a nearby room, Oswako, his uncle, coughed twice, muttered something dreamily, and then resumed his snoring. Ike gingerly stepped out of the shrine. A soft breeze cooled the beads of sweat on his face and neck. He drew several deep breaths and prayed the night to keep his secret. The drafts of air were mixed with the deity's disgusting smell. He kicked out his legs to shake off an incipient cramp. Ike's head, crammed moments before with a jumble of thoughts, of emotions, became strangely uncluttered. The pressure of the statue's weight against his hand and shoulder kept him rooted in the present. He wondered how long he'd been in the shrine, impaled by fear. It seemed to him like hours. Thank you very much.
I have a question for Okay. If we can,
yeah,
can
sure, I you could start it off.
I'm wondering if you have a favorite deity, like maybe someone in the pantheon that you feel is on your side in some way and has shown up for you.
A favorite deity?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Well, in my town, there's actually a deity called Ngene. And so the entire theology of the deity in my novel, the character of the deity is taken from this particular deity called Ngene.
Hmm.
So I'll say that it's
what are the characteristics of this deity?
Well, I used to, as a young kid growing up, and that's my cousin right there, he and I used to sneak into the shrine of this deity, because the chief priest was a man of incredible poetry when he talked and when he offered sacrifices to his deity. And there was something he used to say, and I'm going to say it in Igbo and sort of do a poor job of translating it. Ngene akete, ngene oba, ngene ogisisi ekene kesi bobo obo, obo kaino neenye ifa. So he calls his deity by the praise name, and he says, "You asked us not to share, to scramble, to struggle for it, And he says, that's what we're doing. We're fighting for it. And I used to think that what, you know, in my mind, I used to think that this theology meant that the deity was saying, I have enough for my devotees. So whatever it is that I provide for them, they should not share it. They should just scramble for it because everybody will get enough. But then I asked somebody who was a better student of the deity, and he said that actually that in the ancient days, that deities will gather from different communities and they will receive sacrifice. And that this was the deity from my town saying, out of a great confidence of his power, saying, I don't want us to share what has been offered to us as sacrifice. I want us to fight for it, because he was confident he was going to get most of it. Huh. So the theology then of greed, of gluttony, rather than that of egalitarian sharing. So there was something intriguing about that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Gentleman in back.
Hi. Well, I feel like being IKEA because I have an accent. By listening to you, I feel like a connection with Shinya Achebe, with things fall apart, because I read that recently, and you were talking about deity and other stuff. And I would like to know how much Shinya Achebe influenced you. Because like you talk about deity and you have this connection with deity and things fall apart, what they talk about, the priest, the uncle of the guy, mm-hmm. tall and is the priest of the god. Okay. With Shinya Achebe, the main author, I think is Okonkwo,
mm-hmm. right? Yes, Okonkwo, yes.
Yeah, was one of the priests of the different gods, or one of the gods, if I do remember.
Yes.
So how much Shinya Achebe did influence you,
yes.
and the deity story, is this something really connected to our Nigerian writer?
Mm-hmm. Well, do you want to speak? I don't know if Achebe was important to you.
Yeah.
Is it for me then? Okay. Well, I was privileged to have a very deep relationship with Chinua Achebe. I started reading his works when I was in elementary school. And I was lucky because most of my classmates were reading these novels called by a guy called James Hadley Chase, who happens to be just a name for a number of manufactured novels, you know, written by different people. That was what was, you know, some of my classmates read 100 titles by James Hadley Chase with titles like Do Me a Favor, Drop Dead, or This Is How the Cookie Crumbles. But I was lucky to discover Achebe's Things Fall Apart and to be enchanted by it. And years later, in fact, the year I finished college, a friend of mine, I hate to say girlfriend because in my culture there's a reserve, you know. So I just say female friend of mine happened to be Achebe's niece. And I was visiting her and I was raving because she was from Achebe's town. So I was raving about Chinua Achebe and so on. She said, you know, he's my uncle. I said, really? And she said, he's home for the weekend. Do you want to meet him? So I went and met him. And it was a fantastic meeting. And our relationship deepened even more. And he was the one who brought me to this country to be the founding editor of this magazine that he established. So And my PhD work is partly on his works, you see. So you can say that I'm a product in a very profound way of Achebe's example. But that's really not saying much, because Achebe was the dean of African literature. And so there is hardly any African writer who did not write in his shadows, as it were.
Helen, do you feel like you have escaped his shadow?
You.
For Helen. No, I wasn't. I don't think I was under his shadow in the first place.
Right.
Just,
yes.
That's what I thought. Yeah, another question. Right here in the middle in the green.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask you about the importance of myth in your writing process, and maybe if you can differentiate between using your own culture myth and using myths from other cultures.
Good.
Is that for me?
I think it could be for both of you.
Yeah.
Oh. This is tricky for me. I don't have a sense of a single culture. I'm basically just made up of books and stories that I like, and I just sort of grab things and weave them together. So there's no, there's not really a sense of us and them and an inbuilt culture for me. I just tell a story. Like with Snow White, the way that I retell it is the way that I've read it. I basically read it from the perspective of a modern woman, which is, I read it with a deep suspicion of the mirror. For me, the mirror is the villain of Snow White. It kind of makes this declaration that Snow is the fairest of them all, and then just kind of disappears while all this havoc ensues. And nobody in the story realizes what the mirror has done. And I think that a modern woman would sort of turn around to the mirror and say, well, what are your sources? What do you mean? And what are the criteria of beauty? And have all of these questions. And so I had this heroine who kind of, she feels herself being pushed into the wicked stepmother role, and she doesn't want to do it. It's just hassle. That's another thing about the original fairy tale. I feel like it's a bit half-hearted, the attempts that the wicked queen makes to kill Snow White. I think that if she really wanted to do it, she would have got it done the first time. But to have three tries, like, it just seemed sort of half-hearted. So there were kind of guides within the story for me where I could begin to see a modern woman, and so I wrote her.
Yeah. Well, for me, I grew up and I was an adult in Nigeria before I came to this country. But even in Nigeria, I began to encounter other cultures. So I would say that my formation is a deeply Igbo, specifically Igbo formation. And so when I write, that's sort of the informing mythological scheme for me, Igbo ones. But for me, it's also been enlightening to encounter elsewhere from other cultures, you know, the same other forms of myth that reify or, you know, my own sort of bequest. So in my culture, for example, my first novel especially, there is a grandmother who says to her grandson, who is a journalist, a story that must be told never forgives silence. A story that must be told never forgives silence. And this is something that is a product of several, a kind of compounding of several myths in my society. You know, so there's Eze Onyewanam, you know, which is a king that warned his subjects not to say anything to him, definitely not to say anything critical. So one day the king pulled on himself and was walking around feeling, you know, with a sense of grandeur, and nobody would tell him that he was stinking, you see. So that legislation against speech was something that I then subsequently encountered when I read the works of Sophocles, for example, in Antigone, you know, where you found a king prohibiting burial for one of his subjects. And Antigone, the sister of this young man, decides that her duty was to the memory of her brother, and that her decision to bury her brother in defiance of the king was consistent with, in fact, what she believes that the gods expect her to do. And so I found in Gilgamesh also, when I read the drama of Gilgamesh, I saw this tension, you know, that spoke to me in a powerful way, because it then reminded me of the myths from my society. So when I write, there's all that. And within Nigeria also, because my first novel also, so I talk about a story that must be told, never forgive silence. But part of the inspiration for that particular statement by my protagonist's grandmother is Wole Soyinka, who the Nigerian Nobel Prize laureate, who in his book, The Man Died, which is prison memoirs, had written that a man dies, the man dies in all who keeps silent in the face of tyranny. So the idea of silence and the way that that idea operates in different cultures and different mythologies is something that I've been intrigued by.
We have a few minutes left for a couple more questions. Lady right in front here.
Thank you. Hi, and thank you very much. This is a very odd question. And I'm a professor, and I use this word a lot. Mm-hmm. Juxtaposition. What do you think about juxtaposition, and describe it in the context of your novels, either of you? Thank you.
Huh.
I apologize in advance.
Well, now I might expose these holes in my vocabulary. Juxtaposition. No, I think it's good. You've got my brain cells going now. Well, it's something that I was actually working with from the very beginning. I think that something that all novels do is bring together lots of ideas that might seem disparate to anybody else. So, for example, with me, I've got Snow White, but I've also got 50s and 60s Massachusetts. So I've got America during this time of civil rights when there's this huge debate over the value of a person based on their skin color, which might seem slightly absurd to us now in 2014, at least I hope it is. But back then, it was a very real question that people were kind of sitting around tables arguing about. And then for me, it just seemed immediate that this linked in with Snow White, where it's very explicitly her beauty and her value is tied into the whiteness of her skin. So I was like, this makes complete sense. I had to sell it a little bit to my editor, because she was like, you want to do what with Snow White and set it when? So then I had to sort of write a piece like convincing her that these ideas actually went together. But I think ultimately, you can't really talk about these juxtapositions. You just have to tell the story and let the reader see them, like looking into clear water and seeing what's there, like all the stones and fishes at the bottom. So yeah, that's my answer to your tough question.
And her answer is so brilliant that I'm adopting it.
Last question, gentleman right over here. Yeah, that's you, sir.
How can we go about it promoting the deities of our fathers also, at least so that people are aware of them?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very complex question that would demand a rather elaborate answer. And I'm getting a sense from the enforcer of time here that we don't have that time. So one way of answering it, which a wise man suggested, is to say the answer is in my book. but the point you raise is really, not to be glib, is really important. I want us to respect everybody's rights to religious expression. Unfortunately, there are extremist strains in both Islam and Christianity where they go and destroy shrines, and they take sacred objects and they burn them, you know, in the idea of serving their God. And you also see the tragedy of Nigeria, where some extremist Muslims set themselves, become explosives to kill quote unquote unbelievers, including just last week when 50-something young kids who were sleeping in their dorms were slaughtered at night, you know, by people who feel that they are doing, carrying out God's mandate. So that's particularly disturbing for me. And so what I ask for, and I think, but it's not really within the purview of my novel, but as a citizen, as a social conscience, I would expect that all of us should respect one another's religious sensibilities.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Eleanor Ayemi and O.K. Ndide. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.